So we looked a couple of months ago at Mark chapter 5, verses 1 to 20, and I thought I want to go back to that portion of Scripture, Mark chapter 5, and I wanted to pick up where the previous account, the previous story of verses 1 to 20 ends. So we will look at the account just after that this morning. So I'm going to read the passage for us. We'll read from verse 21 down to verse 43. You can follow along in your own Bibles. And then after I've read the passage, I will just quickly remind you of the context of what is happening here. So you can follow along as I read. Mark chapter 5, verse 21. When Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered around him, and so he stayed by the seashore. One of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up and on seeing him, fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hand on her so that she will get well and live." And he went off with him, and a large crowd was following him and pressing in on him. A woman who had had a hemorrhage for 12 years and had endured much at the hands of many physicians and had spent all that she had and was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse, after hearing about Jesus, she came up in the crowd behind him and touched his cloak. For she thought, "If I just touch his garments, I will get well." Immediately, the flow of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her affliction. Immediately, Jesus, perceiving in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see the woman who had done this. But the woman, fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." While he was still speaking, they came from the house of the synagogue official saying, "Your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore?" But Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, said to the synagogue official, "Do not be afraid any longer. Only believe." And he allowed no one to accompany him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the synagogue official, and he saw a commotion and people loudly weeping and wailing. And entering in, he said to them, "Why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep." They began laughing at him. But putting them all out, he took the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child was. Taking the child by the hand, he said to her, "Talita kum," which translated means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl got up and began to walk, for she was 12 years old, and immediately they were completely astounded. And he gave them strict orders that no one should know about this. And he said that something should be given to her to eat. In the context that precedes this text, in Matthew chapter 4, if we go back all the way to Matthew chapter 4, and the way that Mark portrays this story, it's impossible to figure out where one day ends and the next begins. It's all one series, one flow of events that takes place beginning in Mark chapter 4. And in Mark chapter 4, Jesus is standing beside the Sea of Galilee and he's teaching the crowds, or the crowds gathered. He's teaching them all day long and he's teaching them in parables. And then towards the end of the day, as the crowds begin to leave and they go home, he turns to his disciples and he begins to instruct them now. He explains all the parables that he'd been teaching to the crowds all day long. And then as the sun begins to set, presumably, I would think, although Mark doesn't make this point, as the sun begins to set, it's the end of the day, Jesus turns to his disciples and he says to them, "There's one more thing we must do. One more thing needs to happen before this day is done." And so he gets his disciples to get into the boat that he'd been using all day long, and they row out across the Sea of Galilee. As they sail out on the water, an exhausted Jesus lies down and falls asleep in the stern of this boat, as if Sealy Posturepedic had made their start in the first century making seat cushions, right? He's out. And while Jesus sleeps, a storm sweeps in across the lake and gets so out of control that these seasoned sailors begin to fear for their own lives. What starts as an attempt to maintain their course that they had set very quickly turns into an all-out struggle just for survival. And in the midst of all of this, one of the disciples notices something absolutely incredible. Jesus is still sleeping. It's unbelievable. And so the disciples, in utter disbelief, awaken the Messiah, and they ask him a crucially important question. Teacher, do you not care? Instead of answering their question, Jesus turns his attention away from the disciples and to the raging storm, and with a single command, quiets the storm. Right. In an instant, the storm that had been raging outside in the ocean now rages in the hearts of the disciples as they are confronted with what they just saw. And on their lips come a second crucial question. The second question they ask is, who is this? What kind of man is this Jesus that even the wind and the sea obey him? It seems to me, as I study this text, that Mark chapter 5 is really devoted to answering those two questions. Mark 5 wants to give us the answer to the question of who Jesus is. Who is Jesus? Well, to begin with, Jesus is mighty, right? He is mighty enough to calm a storm. He has might over nature. Calms a storm with a single command. But not only does he have might over nature, he also has might over the supernatural. Because just as he calms a storm with a single command, so he drives out a legion of demons, supernatural beings, with a similarly uttered single command. But that's not all, right? Mark continues, there's more. Jesus' might is demonstrated now in the second half of Mark, in our text for this morning, not just by showing his power over disease, but even his power over death itself. So Jesus is mighty. But secondly, we see that he's not just mighty, Jesus is also merciful. Right? The disciples ask him, do you not care that we are perishing? And the answer is, of course he cares, right? Of course Jesus cares. That's why he came to earth in the first place, because he cares. That's why he left the glories of heaven, because he cares, because he loves us. So then you have this story in Mark chapter 5, verses 1 to 20, where this mercy and might of Jesus is beautifully put on display for us. It is the mercy that motivates Jesus to cross over the Sea of Galilee, knowing full well what awaits him, knowing that a harrowing storm waits for them on the lake, knowing that wholesale rejection waits for him on the other side of the lake, right? All the people of the Decapolis reject Jesus. They just want him to leave. And still he goes. Why? Because he cares. Because he cares for one struggling sufferer. He goes to deliver one man from his torments. But listen, there is a third question in Mark chapter 4. This question comes from the lips of Jesus himself. This question is no less important than the other two. Jesus asks his disciples, why are you afraid? How is it that you have no faith? See, in Mark 5, we're not just confronted by the character of Jesus. Mark 5 also confronts us with something about our own characters. We are confronted with something deep within ourselves. To give ourselves over to faith in Christ. And we need to figure out why that is. Why is it that it is so hard to believe in Jesus? these stories in Mark, these three stories really in Mark 5, the story of verses 1 to 20 is the first story, and then two more in our text for this morning. These three stories present us with an invitation. This is an invitation for us to trust Jesus. See, he is faithful. But there's more than an invitation. Underneath the surface of these stories, there is an exhortation. There is a command here. We are slow learners. It's not a lesson we learn easily. And so under God's providential direction, Mark repeats this lesson for us three times. We are presented with the same fact three times. Jesus is powerful, and Jesus has compassion. So not just the invitation, come to him, but the exhortation, come to him. Do not be afraid, Jesus says. Only believe. And our passage for this morning very naturally divides into three sections. Each of these sections centers on the encounter of an individual with Christ. So often that's the case in the gospel narratives. Our outline for this morning is going to be, we're going to see in verses 21 to 24, we're going to see the supplicant, right? That's the first encounter, is between Jesus and the supplicant. The second encounter is between Jesus and a supplicant. That's verses 25 to 34. And then the third one is between Jesus and the sleeper. That's verses 35 to 43. Okay, so the supplicant, the sufferer, and the sleeper. We come to the first episode in the story, like I say, in verse 21. And we meet the supplicant here in the first two verses, verses 21 and 22. This synagogue official is a man named Jairus. Synagogue officials the synagogue officials were made up of a small group of elders. These are men who were elders in the community. They had the responsibility, the oversight for everything that happens within the synagogues, right? With the position of a synagogue official comes an incredible amount of esteem and respect in his area. Synagogue officials also typically were chosen from the wealthiest portion of society, so these were men of means, men of influence, men of as a synagogue official, Jairus would have been working very closely with the scribes and the Pharisees just because of his role in the synagogue. And it's no secret how the scribes and the Pharisees and the rest of the Jewish leaders feel about Jesus. If you consider their hostility, the hostility that the Jewish leaders felt towards Jesus, then for Jairus to come and publicly fall down at the feet of Christ, that's no small thing. Right? That is an act that demonstrates profound humility. It's a bold display of someone who considers the other person to be worthy of more honor and more respect than themselves. This act would have done damage to Jairus' standing in the social pecking order. Right? It would have cost him in very real ways to go and fall down before the feet of Jesus. As you read, it seems to be almost something of a finality to the way that Mark describes the scene. You imagine Jairus coming and collapsing before Jesus, because there is just nowhere else for him to go. It is Jesus or no one. Not only that, but verse 23, if you look there, it says, Jairus implored Jesus earnestly. That word for implored, I think in the ESV, is the word begged. It's a word that is repeated three times. If you were here for that sermon in chapter 5, verses 1 to 20, it's a word that gets repeated three times in that section. The demons beg Jesus to be cast into the swine. The former demoniac begs Jesus to accompany him, and the people of the Decapolis beg Jesus to leave their area alone, right? You have this repetition of the word beg happening in the first half of this chapter. Now Jairus comes and he also begs, but synagogue officials don't beg. They demand. They don't collapse in front of teachers in an utter demonstration of dependence and humility. So what drives Jairus to such an action? What makes him do such a thing? Well, verse 23 explains for us, right? He's a desperate father. He's a father whose love for his dying daughter is stronger than any sense of propriety or pride. he would gladly risk public ridicule for the sake of his daughter's life. Right? It's a cost he pays happily. He'll gladly accept the embarrassment by kneeling at the feet of Jesus and begging him, please come to my home, heal my daughter. Because, like, this little girl isn't just sick. Right? She's not just sick, she's dying. In fact, by the time the Jairus reaches Jesus, this little girl is hanging by a thread over the precipice of death. In the NASB, it says that Jairus asks Jesus to lay hands on her so that she will get well and live. I'm not crazy about that translation. The word for get well there is the Greek word sozo. It's the word that is usually translated in the New Testament as saved, right? What Jairus is doing here is he's pleading with Jesus to save his little girl because she's in the clutches of death. She needs to be delivered from the clutches of death. Please come and save my little girl so that she might live. That's what Jairus is asking. It's really interesting also that in the Gospel of Mark, at least, Jairus is the first person who has the boldness and just the desperation to come to Jesus and to beg him to leave the crowds. Please leave all of these people and come serve me. Come minister to my family personally. Come away from all these people. Come to my house and help me. I need your help. Jairus is the first person bold enough to ask that in the Gospel of Mark. And we have every confidence that Jesus will, right? Because if you've been reading through the Gospel of Mark, you just read verses 1 to 20. You know that Jesus just crossed over the Sea of Galilee, just went through a storm, and he did all of it just to save one man. So it's no surprise to us when verse 4 simply tells us that he went off with him. And this large crowd is following him and pressing in on him. Now in the Gospel of Mark, the crowd is so often a force of its own. So I imagine the scene, as I do with all these gospel narratives, I imagine the scene of Jairus, who's a really important person in his community. Everyone knows him. Everyone respects him. He has authority. He has esteem. He has power. As he's coming, the crowd parts. You know, if you're a nobody, good luck getting through the crowd. But Jairus isn't a nobody. He's a somebody. So I imagine people making way for him in respect as he makes his way towards Jesus. But now, as they prepare to set off to the house of this synagogue official, verse 24 says that the crowds are pressing in on them. Suddenly the crowd becomes a hindrance. It is crushing, suffocating. Everyone is urgent to try and see what's going to happen. This important ruler has now come to Jesus. What's they going to talk about? What's going to happen? So the crowd presses in on them, boxing them in, making their progress painfully slow. Again, imagine the scene. Imagine Jairus's absolute frustration at, you know, he's now got Jesus. Jesus has agreed to go with him. Finally, they're going to go get help for his little girl. And they can't move fast enough. Right? They can't get moving. This crowd is pressing in on them. And his little girl is dying. His frustration, however, is about to reach new heights. Because in the second episode of the story, we're introduced to the second character. Right? In verses 25 to 34, we meet the sufferer. Now, unlike Jairus, who is named in the story, who is well known in his community, this lady remains unnamed. Her tragic story is told all at once in a series of short but detailed descriptions. So look at verse 25 and 26. It says, a woman who had had a hemorrhage for 12 years and had endured much at the hands of many physicians and had spent all that she had and was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse. So all this comes out. Her whole story. I wonder if you've ever had a wound that took a long time to heal. Very shortly, Taryn's always been frustrated by my willingness to take risks and be what she would describe as somewhat irresponsible. She probably wouldn't say I'm somewhat irresponsible at times, but anyway, it's always been a frustration for her, and that manifested itself very much in surfing. And very shortly after we got married, maybe like 4 weeks, less than a month after we got married, I went surfing in Jeffreys Bay once, and as I was paddling out, My foot got cut. There are muscle banks like rocks. You know, my foot got cut on the rocks. And the water was quite cold, so it restricts blood flow. I didn't see how bad it was. The waves were amazing, so I kept surfing for something like 3 hours. And like, it didn't really bother me. And then when I went back into the land and I stood up on the solid ground, it was just like this gush of blood. And I realized, ooh, that's a bit more serious than I thought. It's a lot of blood. So I try and wrap something around my foot. We used to live very close to the beach there. And so I go home, try and wash it out a little bit as much as I can, not too grossed out by the cuts and things like that. And so put a bandage on, and I think, ugh, it'll be fine. You know, it's bled so much, everything will be out, it's fine. But like 3 or 4 days later, my foot's still bleeding. Into a conference in Cape Town, and we're there in Cape Town, my foot's still bleeding. It doesn't, like, I'm at this conference and I have to walk around barefoot. It's like a pastor's shepherd's conference, right? I'm walking around barefoot because my foot won't stop bleeding. So I went to a doctor in Cape Town. It was my first of many doctor's visits. Many subsequent visits followed as the doctors tried to get this wound to stop bleeding. It just wouldn't. It took something like 3 months before they could get that thing to just kind of begin to dry out and heal normally. This lady had not been suffering with a wound that wouldn't stop bleeding for 3 months. She'd been suffering for 12 years. 12 years. Verse 26 says that she had endured much at the hands of many physicians. She had tried one remedy after the other. I don't want to take the time, but if you go read the remedies that these people had, it's like, it's crazy, right? Like, we can be thankful that we live in a time in world history where there's medical research, you know, like, say what you want to about medical research. It's better than what it used to be, right? So she had tried every remedy she could find. She was always trying to find a better doctor, always hoping that this would be the cure that would finally work. Always just spending more and more of her limited resources until finally she had exhausted all of her resources, spent everything that she had. The severity of her suffering drove her to a desperation to give up all in the hopes of finding relief, and she didn't. Nothing helped. Instead, her condition only got worse. Her suffering only seemed to get worse and worse as the years went by. Now, it's important to recognize, just apart from the physical trauma that she would have endured, there's a lot of related trauma associated with her condition, right? Leviticus 15 explains that she would have been ceremonially unclean because of this wound that wouldn't stop bleeding. So anyone, because she's ceremonially unclean, she wouldn't be allowed to go into the synagogue, right? She wouldn't be able to go. But it's worse than that, because anyone who comes into contact with her would also be ceremonially unclean. More than that, anything that she touches, if someone else touches that same thing, they are ceremonially unclean. Okay. So people would not have wanted to have any contact with her. More than likely, she would have been driven out of the home of her childhood if she had still lived at home, if she had been married. It's hard to imagine that her husband would not long ago have divorced her and set her aside, which is very common practice. This woman is the exact opposite to Jairus in almost every way, right? She is destitute. She is an outcast from society. The only thing that she and Jairus have in common with each other, in fact, is the hope of Jesus. Their desperation had driven both of them to Jesus to go find help there. Verse 27 says that after hearing about Jesus, she came up in the crowd behind him and touched his cloak. Again, I imagine the scene, right? About stories, about this Galilean teacher and a miracle worker making their way to her. And here's this guy. He says all these really interesting things, but it's amazing. Like, he's actually healing people miraculously. He's like curing blindness and stuff. So you can imagine this woman, this little spark of hope that she had thought had long since been extinguished, suddenly begins to rage again into a blaze of expectation. But it's interesting as you read the story, as she comes to Jesus, there seems to be something almost sneaky about the way that she goes about this whole thing. Unlike Jairus, who approaches Jesus openly and falls down before him and pleads with him, this woman plans to sneak up behind Jesus, hiding her touch of his garments in the press of the crowd. Verse 28 explains her confidence in Jesus' power, for she thought, if I could just touch his garments, I will get well. Again, Mark uses that same word, sozo, for salvation. If I can just touch his garments, I will be saved from my affliction. As her furtive fingers grab hold of his garment, for just the briefest of moments, healing rushes through her body like a bucket of ice poured out over her head. Have you ever had a splinter or something stuck in your skin that you couldn't get out? And like days go by and the agitation grows and gets worse and worse and worse, right? And then finally you get it out and the relief is like amazing. Again, imagine 12 years of affliction and then instantaneous healing. Just imagine what that must have been like for her. Anyway, her plan is to sneak up behind Jesus, touch his garment, just quickly, without anyone seeing or knowing what's going on, hide it in the crowd, and then once she's healed, just disappear, slip off quietly, without anyone knowing. I'm sure part of the reason why she was sneaking about was because she understood that she had no business being there, right? This woman is ceremonially unclean. She's in a crowd. Everyone who touches her becomes unclean. She would not be welcome in places like this. But all her hopes of a quiet escape disappear as the voice of the one whose power had changed her life forever rings out with command. Verse 30 shows that Jesus is every bit as much aware of the miracle as she was. Immediately, Jesus, perceiving in himself the power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" The story is amusing if you think about the details. It's really a fascinating moment. I just think about Jesus is in this crowd that's pressing in on him, and as he turns around and scans the crowd and asks, "Who touched my garments?" You can imagine how the people respond. They're amused, maybe confused a little bit. What does he mean? But not so the woman, right? That question stops her in her tracks like a 5-ton anchor tied to her ankle. The disciples express their sheer befuddlement at the question. "You see the crowd, right, Jesus? Who's touching you? Everybody's touching you. What are you talking about?" It's really funny in Matthew's account of this story, the people begin to say, they all begin to deny touching him. I didn't touch you. They're all touching him. Stop and imagine what Jairus must be thinking, right? Jairus' little girl lies dying. He just wants to get Jesus there. And now Jesus is stopping mid-stride and beginning to ask questions about who's touching his clothes, right? And he just wants to get Jesus to his daughter. You have to remember that as far as everyone else is concerned, nothing out of the ordinary has happened, right? No one except for Jesus and this woman are aware of the magnitude of the miracle that just took place. The whole crowd, including the disciples, they're all oblivious. No one knows. No words have been exchanged between Jesus and this woman. Now, it's also interesting that he would ask, right? It's interesting that Jesus would ask, "Who touched me?" I don't think he asked the question because he didn't know. I think Jesus knew who she was. I mean, he had healed her, right? I think he knew who she was. Verse 32 specifically says that Jesus looked around to see the woman who had done this. Not Jesus looked around to see who had done this. No, he wanted to find the woman who had done this. I think he knew who she was. I think he asks the question not to find information, but to create an opportunity for her to come forward. You see, Jesus is not yet done ministering to this woman. He has more to give her. Verse 33 tells us, but the woman, fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. Right, this description of her fearfully coming and falling down before Jesus and then telling him the whole truth speaks loudly to the, almost, I'm going to say, the deceptive nature, right? The dishonesty of her actions up to this point. It's like she's not telling the truth. So she comes forward and confesses what she had done, what she had tried to take from Jesus. It's really interesting. It's surprising to me, actually, as you read this account, that her fear doesn't seem to be related to the fact that she'd been caught out. That's not why she's afraid. Mark says she's afraid because she's aware of what had happened to her. Her fear is related to the instantaneous nature of her healing. She has the same fear as the disciples in the boat. She has the same fear as the people from the Decapolis to come and to find this former demoniac who's now calm and in his right mind. She has the same question as the disciples. What kind of man is this? You see, she had come thinking, maybe he would be the man who finally had the ability to heal her. But 12 years of suffering should have taught her that no man had the ability to heal her. When she touched his garment, what she discovered is that Jesus is no ordinary man. Jesus has the power over disease, because his power is divine. She had ventured into the presence of holiness itself. And like Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 6, she understood perfectly well that she had no business being where she was. But again, we see how Jesus calms a raging storm with a single word. The turmoil in this woman is stilled with just one word. Daughter. Daughter, Jesus calls her. Did you know that this is the only place in all the gospel accounts, this is the only place where Jesus calls a woman daughter. This is the only place where this word is used. It reminded me a lot of Mark chapter 2, earlier in the gospel of Mark, where the paralytic is brought by his friends to Jesus, and how Mark says how Jesus, seeing their faith, said to the paralytic, "Son." It's the same thing. In this brief exchange between these two, we see again this beautiful blending of Jesus' might and his mercy. So why does he call her forward? I think, first and foremost, well, firstly, I should say, he calls her forward because he wants to reassure her. He wants to set her free to a certain extent. I think that's why he calls her daughter. It's why he tells her to go in peace. I think most of us can't even imagine the extent of the torment that she had been suffering for 12 years, but now Jesus sends her away in peace. Her life had been utter turmoil, and he says to her, go in peace. But this isn't just the peace that comes from no longer having to struggle against the torment of her physical affliction, her disease. It is not just the peace that comes from once again being able to enter into loving relationships with people in society. Instead, it is the peace that comes from being able to be reconciled with God himself, to enter into relationship with him. It's the peace that comes to one who has confessed the whole truth, who has received healing, and who has received forgiveness and adoption. Again, the NASB falls short when it translates the word sozo as made you well. It's not enough. What Jesus says here to her is literally, your faith has saved you. Her faith, I think, has saved her from more than just her affliction, though. And there's another reason, I think, why Jesus calls her back. Yes, he wanted to reassure her, but more importantly, I think Jesus wanted to instruct her. As you see, she had come thinking of Jesus as nothing more than a, shall we call him, a health battery. She needed a health recharge, and so all she needed to do was to complete the circuit by touching him so that health can flow from him into her. She had snuck up behind Jesus to take health from him without his knowledge. What she didn't realize is that you can't sneak up on God, and you cannot take anything from God that he does not freely give you. She'd not taken healing from him. He had freely and lovingly given it to her. So he says to her, it is your faith that saved you. It is not your touch that saved you. What Jesus does for this woman is beautiful. It's a beautiful reassurance and instruction as he ministers to her. But it's hard to rejoice with someone when their delight leads directly to your own despair, which is what happens to Jairus. Through all of this, I can only imagine that Jairus' agitation must have been getting worse and worse and worse. Okay, Jesus, that's beautiful, great. Can we go? She's healthy. These brief moments of exchange between Heavenly Father and his daughter would have felt like hours to Jairus. Because even as they spoke, his little girl is lying in the clutches of death. In verse 35, we come to the third and final episode in this story as we are introduced to the sleeper. When Jairus sees those men approaching from his home, he knows his worst fears have just realized. Verse 35 says, while Jesus was still speaking, they came from the house of the synagogue official saying, your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore? Despite his every effort, despite all his eagerness and everything he's done, Jairus is too late. He is not successful. His little girl has died. While Jesus brings an end to the 12-year-long suffering of this woman, death brings a conclusion to the suffering of his own 12-year-old daughter. So the men ask him, why trouble the teacher anymore? It's too late. Right? Implicit in that question is the belief that there had been an opportunity. Right? Maybe, who knows? Maybe while she was suffering, Jesus would have been able to do something for her. But now that she's died, we'll never know. This is over. You almost see the despair wash over Jairus. I picture him with his shoulders slumping as he crumples into himself and turns away from Jesus to walk away in utter despair. In verse 36, we read that Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, said to the synagogue official, do not be afraid any longer, only believe. It's an interesting word, overhearing. It's an interesting word. Every other place it gets used in the New Testament and in the Greek translation of the Old Testament as well, actually, when this word gets used, it's for hearing something that you disregard. You hear something, but then you choose to ignore it. You disregard it. You don't care about it. I think that's what's happening here. Jesus hears what these people are saying to Jairus, and he ignores it. Jesus wants Jairus to learn something from the faith of this woman, and so he says, do not be afraid any longer. Only believe. You see, Jairus had come with faith and desperation. But now his faith has faltered. His desperation has turned into despair. It's amazing to see how Jesus controls even the smallest of details in this story. the crowd that had been pressing in, that had been such a challenge all along, ever since Mark chapter 4, now suddenly it's just a non-issue, right? When it suits his purposes, he simply dismisses the crowd. They're not a problem anymore. It's only after the little girl's death reaches them that Jesus begins to hurry. Verse 37, he allowed no one to accompany him. Like, so no crowds, you can't come, you must stay. He only allows Peter, James, and John to go with him. It's a lot like the death of Lazarus in John 11. Jesus waits for Lazarus to die before he decides, oh, let's go. You know, Lazarus has been sick for a few days, he's now died, so let's go. When they finally get to the house of Jairus, we see that one crowd has now been exchanged for another. Because it says in verse 38, they came to the house of the synagogue official and he saw a commotion and people loudly weeping and wailing. But these people were prepped and ready. This girl had been sick. They knew she was on the verge of death. Now she has died and so they're ready. Now they're wailing and they're weeping and, you know, they're mourning for them. Entering in, Jesus said to them, why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died but is asleep. And you see the lack of their sincerity. This is no real mourning. This is no real sympathy because their mourning turns into jeering on a dime, right? It just changes. Verse 40 says, they began laughing at him. But putting them all out, Jesus took only the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child was. Okay, when Jesus says the child is only asleep, he's not denying the facts, right? The point that Jesus is making is the same point that the New Testament makes over and over again when it refers to the believer's death as sleep. Right? When he talks about believers falling asleep. The point is that death isn't permanent. This little girl's died, but her death is going to last about as long as the average afternoon nap. It's not done. So Jesus says she's just asleep. Look at verse 41. Taking the child by the hand, he said to her, Talita kum, which translated means, little girl, I say to you, get up. Another interesting detail. You see here in verse 41, something of the impact that these events had on the lives of the disciples. There's a quirk to the way that Mark tells this story. It's unusual. Have you ever wondered why Mark includes the exact Aramaic phrase that Jesus spoke in that room? It wasn't there. Why use the Aramaic phrase? Our church tradition tells us that Mark was Peter's disciple and that the gospel of Mark is the result of Peter's own teachings, Peter's own telling of the gospel events, right? So Mark follows Peter along as his disciple and he collects all the stories, all the sayings that Peter tells of Jesus and he compiles them in what is the gospel of Mark. Mark writes decades after the events took place, but whenever he remembers this story, he thinks about how Peter would tell it, including the very words that Jesus spoke in that room. I don't think Peter ever told the story without directly quoting the very command that Jesus uttered in that room. They forever rang in his ears, Talita kum. Little girl, I say to you, get up. Make no mistake. Those words rang with the authority of divine command. It's a 12-year-old girl, right? She's beginning to go into teenage years. I wonder how many times in her life her mom had to wake her up in the mornings. I wonder how many times her mom used that exact phrase. Get up, little girl. If she's anything like a normal child, I'm assuming there were days when her mom had to repeat that same command quite a few times before she finally listened. Not this time. This time, she responds immediately. This time, her obedience is instantaneous. Verse 42 says, immediately the girl got up and began to walk. It's really interesting if you think about it. Jesus speaks to the little girl because dead people can't hear. So one commentator says, it is death itself that Jesus is addressing. Verse 43 shows us something about the personal care that Jesus has for individuals. Jesus doesn't just raise her to life. But he instructs that something should be given to her because she's hungry. Now, just as an aside, the fact that she is hungry demonstrates something about the instantaneous nature of her healing, right? When people are sick and they begin to get hungry, that's a pretty good sign. It means they're on the mend. This girl wakes up from death. She's starving. So Jesus says, give her something to eat. But I want us to go back to verse 41 for a second. Notice how Jesus takes her by the hand. Like the woman with the hemorrhage, coming into contact with this little dead girl would have left Jesus ceremonially unclean according to the Mosaic law. We see this so often in the Gospels, how unclean people come to Jesus and he engages with them physically. But instead of Jesus being defiled by that interaction, what happens is that they are cleansed. They are sanctified. You see, Jesus cannot be defiled. But he can sanctify. The demoniac, the woman with the hemorrhage, and even this little girl all serve for us as a picture of what it is that happens to us at the moment of our own salvation. Jesus takes our sin, our uncleanness upon himself, and at the same time, he gives us his righteousness. Our defilement is taken away, and we're made clean. We're given his cleanness. That's why we can come to God. Because as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, the Father made the Son who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf so that we might become the righteousness of God in Christ. Now, the three questions of Mark chapter 4 find their answer in Mark chapter 5. Do you not care that we are perishing? Of course he cares. He cares so much that he leaves the glories of heaven to be born in a stable, in a feeding trough. There's nothing glamorous about that. To live a life of obedience and rejection and being despised by people, being spat on, only to die on a cross. And in between those moments, in between him leaving the glory of heaven to be born in a stable and dying on a cross, in between those two events, Jesus lives his life seeking out poor and desperate and miserable individuals who have no hope outside of himself. Individuals like the demoniac who is tormented, driven away from people. Individuals like you and me, who were dead in our trespasses and sins, who were held captive by the prince of the power of the air, who were without God and without hope in this world. So who is this, that even the wind and the sea would obey him? Who is Jesus? Well, he is a mighty and merciful Savior who has the power not only over nature, but over the supernatural. Not only over disease, but over death itself. He can deliver us. And then there's a third question that Jesus himself asks. Why are you afraid? How is it that you have no faith? It's a question that confronts the battle for belief that rages in each of our hearts. Listen, we know who Jesus is. He's mighty. He's merciful. He's full of grace and truth, John tells us. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter if you're famous or an outcast. It doesn't matter if you're old or young. It doesn't matter who you are. What matters is who he is. He is mighty and he is merciful. And he stands ready to pour out saving and sustaining grace upon your life. So my prayer really for this morning is that you will hear this invitation, this exhortation that Jesus extends not just to Jairus but to each of us. Do not be afraid, only believe. Let's pray. Father, I marvel at the fact that we can trust you. You are worthy of our faith. You are powerful. You are compassionate and gracious. Your kindness, your grace, your goodness is manifested for us in Jesus. It is in him that your love is poured out on us. And we have beheld his glory full of grace and truth. Thank you for the invitation that we can come. Thank you that Jesus calls us again and again to come to him. We praise you for the knowledge that one day he will come back to us. I pray for all of us that we will stand ready on that day, that we will be found clothed in the righteousness and the love and compassion of Christ on that day. Amen.